Fascination with the private lives of the rich, the famous and the talented is hardly new. Ever since there have been stars, Shakespeare, ancient Greek theatre, there have been people dying to know their innermost secrets. The fact is, artists are usually given such license when they're famous that it would be surprising if they weren't tempted to become mad, bad and dangerous to know, like famous bad boy Lord Byron. Professor Geoffrey Smith from Otago University wanted to know how much bad character affects our love or hatred of their creations. So he wrote a book, Scoundrels, Cads and Other Great Artists. I asked Jeff how much of this is just scurrilous gossip.
There's a fair amount of scurrilous gossip in it, but hopefully everything that is in there is true. These were some reprehensible human beings, by and large, although not all of them.
There's a couple of saving graces in there, is what you're implying.
That's correct. That's correct. In particular, Artemisia Gentileschi, who was a late Renaissance artist who was not a scoundrel or a cad, but had horrible things happen to her and overcame them in her life. It was difficult, Simon, to find female artists who were really reprehensible human beings. That group needs to up their game on being scurrilous.
Is it true that we prefer our artists to have, shall we say, a certain edge rather than being dull and hardworking?
I would say probably yes, although I think in many instances we don't really know a whole lot about the artists who we like. I'm trying to think of one now Magritte wore a suit and tie to paint in and you know, was fairly straightforward human being, and a number of artists, art was kind of the second job, the avocation as much as the vocation, and they had rather mundane lives, but not the folks here.
Well, let's get into it. I mean, Caravaggio famously was a murderer. Tell me about him.
He was indeed, although I don't think he really intended it. Caravaggio, he was a horrible human being, actually. During the day, he would paint these amazing religious paintings. He was the favorite of popes and cardinals and bishops, and that's where he would get his commissions. And so he would do these stunning chiaroscuro paintings during the day. And then in the evenings, he would go out and drink himself into oblivion, get into bar fights, attack people. He was once arrested for singing lewd songs at his landlady's apartment because she was upset with him because he wasn't paying the rent. He once also, one of my favorite Caravaggio stories, he once had ordered a plate of asparagus at a pub, and it came cooked two ways, in oil and in butter. And he asked the waiter which part was oil and which part was butter, and the waiter said, "Well, smell them, you'll be able to tell." And so he picked up the plate and smashed it into the waiter's face.
I think he had it coming to him personally.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, he could have just not tipped him, but
that's not how he rolls. Caravaggio doesn't do that. I think it's kind of significant, actually, that Caravaggio is famous for his blacks. You know, the shadows and the dark in his amazing paintings clearly reflect a sort of a dark sort of soul, perhaps.
You know, it's a funny thing you say that, Simon. Whenever I think of Caravaggio, I think of him at night. I think of him as sort of pub crawling in dark alleyways and streets, and all of my images of him are in this chiaroscuro settings in bars and pubs. But he really took that technique. The chiaroscuro means light and dark, of course, just for audience members who might not know what we're talking about here. And so he would put everything in a dark setting, and then he would cast light on his on the people he wanted to feature in the painting.
I see that you've devoted a chapter to Oscar Wilde's mate James Whistler. Now, what was wrong with him?
Oh, I love James Whistler. Whistler was an incredible braggart and blowhard, something of a womanizer, mostly didn't treat the women in his life very well. One time, his wife was pregnant, and he put her up in a hotel and said, "This would be a better place for you to be here because I have to go to Paris for the next 3 or 4 months, and it'll be better if you're over here in this hotel. And then, of course, he never went to Paris. He just wanted to have her out of the way during the pregnancy so that he didn't have to deal with it. He was a West Pointer. He was a cadet at West Point, and he got thrown out of West Point by none other than Robert E. Lee, the lead general of the Confederacy during the war, and then went to work for the Coast Guard, where he was making etchings of coastal lands and things like that. But he thought that those etchings would really be better for the Coast Guard if they had like mermaids in them as well. And so the Coast Guard didn't think that was all such a great idea. They fired him. He goes off to London and Paris, never returns to the United States, claims to have been a West Point graduate, claims to have been born in St. Petersburg, Russia, when in fact he was born in Lowell, Massachusetts. And he just battled with everybody constantly.
I'm intrigued, speaking of people who are, you know, no strangers to guns, with Remington. Now, all I know about Remington is he was the great Western illustrator. He painted the Wild West, basically.
Remington, of all the people, Remington, I think, at some level, I find the most objectionable, although he's got kind of a kinder side to him. But basically, he was a xenophobe is what he was. He was a bigot. And he was born in New York and went to Yale for a year and then dropped out of Yale. His father died. I think he couldn't pay the tuition or something. Went out west and made some sketches, which he sent back to Harper's Weekly, which later became Harper's Bazaar. And they picked him up and published them. And so he thought maybe this would be something he could do. He came back from the West, got married, goes out to what he kind of thought was the West, but was really Kansas City, which is barely Midwest right. in the United States. And he tries being a farmer. He tries being a saloon keeper. He tries a variety of different, fails at all of them. His wife gets upset with him, leaves him. She goes back to New York. So he goes out west and he tries his hand at this and he's pretty successful. The other thing he does, he takes his camera with him, takes a lot of pictures, gathers up a lot of souvenirs and memorabilia, heads back east. He only ever spends about 3 years total in the West, because out in the West, he's this dumpy, overweight tin horn from the East, whereas in the East, he's a rootin' tootin', hard-living cowboy from the West, which is really the image he would rather portray. But it's the Gilded Age. It's a time of Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders and also massive immigration into the U.S. from Eastern Europe and from China, a variety of places. And at one point, Remington says, I'm quoting here, I've got some Winchesters, those are rifles, and when the massacring begins, I can get my share of them, and what's more, I will. Injuns, Jews, Chinamen, Italians, Huns, the rubbish of the earth, I hate them. And so that's kind of what gained Remington entry into the book. But at the same time, he paints these gorgeous paintings of Native Americans.
This is the point of the book, really, in some respects, isn't it, Jeff? Because, I mean, on the one hand, it's what that business about hate the man, love the art and stuff. But, I mean, can you always do that? And does it depend on which you were aware of first, the person or the art?
That's a very good point. And Remington is a good example of it because people who focus on his life and his bigotry also are highly critical of his art. And people who really love the art, maybe really saw these gorgeous paintings first, tend to want to somehow forgive and forget the bigotry part of his life.
How many of these people's reputations were ruined by a revelation, or did they, you know, was it just kind of accepted as part of who they were?
I think more the latter than the former. In all honesty, although there may be exceptions to that, with some of them, with a couple of them, it was the art itself that sort of made them notorious. I mean, Egon Schiele is maybe the best example of that. He is a fascinating guy who was a student of Gustav Klimt, if that's a name you recognize.
Oh, absolutely. The Austrian guy with lots of gold.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And Sheila was a mentee of Gustav Klimt and was accepted into the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna when he was only 16 years old. And an interesting story on that is the year after he started there and the year after that, that same academy turned down Adolf Hitler as a student. Hitler later goes into politics. But Sheila paints highly erotic paintings of men and women, himself a lot, but also of underage girls and underage boys in very erotic poses. When he was 22 years old, he was arrested for kidnap and rape. Charges weren't true. He had helped a young girl try to escape her father, and the father filed charges against him. But the fact that he painted underage people in erotic poses is, you know, undeniable. And whenever there's a Sheila exhibit, these issues come to the fore. And what's fascinating about him, and in part, when you read about these people, they all tend to have some redeeming factor in there that makes you somewhat sympathetic. He dies at age 28 in the 1918 flu epidemic, and his wife had become ill first, and he wouldn't let her mother or his mother, anyone else, to take care of her, insisted on taking care of her himself, which almost surely would doom him to getting the disease. And she dies, and in fact, he dies 3 days later at age 28. But for the case of Sheila, the sort of the damning aspect of his life isn't his life itself, but the art that he made.
I found it interesting comparing and contrasting the people that you're talking about here, Jeff, with, you know, celebrities who's had their careers ruined by revelations. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, certain modern day ones that we don't really need to name. They're kind of pretty well known. But there is a difference. The difference is that their celebrities and their fame is tied up entirely with them being accepted by audiences. You draw a distinction by saying that with a painter, the painting is just more removed from perhaps the character of the artist. And so you can maybe look at that at a slight distance.
I think that's an excellent point, Simon. And additionally, with the artists I have, they're all gone. They're all, you know, you're not supporting their, if I go look at a Caravaggio or a Jackson Pollock, you know, or a Whistler painting, I'm not supporting them financially. But, you know, if I go and see Shakespeare in Love or Good Will Hunting or The King's Speech, then, in fact, I'm financially benefiting one of those people who won't be named,
right,
but whom you're referring to. Mm. And I think there's a difference there. The moral issue is a tough one, though. I I'm not settled on it. I mean, I'm a psychologist by training, not a philosopher, and so I tend to look at questions more like, you know, why do we love these artists who were bad people, as opposed to should we love these artists who were bad people? That's a question above my pay grade. That's a tough one. And in all honesty, be honest, I don't know where I come down on that. But I do know that when I look at a Caravaggio, I know that his life in bars, in pubs, in the street, always carrying a sword with him, even though it was against the law at the time, constantly getting in fights. So that when I look at the art that is, you know, crucifixions or beheadings or whatever, I take into account the fact that I'm looking at a guy who was no stranger to blood in the streets himself. And it affects how I look at what's going on. So if I compare him to a Magritte, yeah, I think we do take lives into account.
That's Jeffrey Smith, whose book Scoundrels, Cads and Other Great Artists is out now, published by Roman and Littlefield. And I have to say, there's some great stories in there and even better pictures.